So would anyone ask anything at all? Don't have to worry about, you know, saying something that's basic or... Yes. Okay, so the question was, given that at least as Buddhists understand, believe the Buddha was blessed with all kinds of supernatural powers and godlike powers, he never claimed to be God or a god. In fact, the Buddha's teaching career began with failure, and it's something that few Buddhists talk about, but directly following his enlightenment, he was unsure whether there was anybody really who could understand what he had to teach. But eventually he was persuaded, or he decided that there were people in the world who could understand. It's a beautiful phrase in the Pali. It said people with little dust in their eyes. So it means like most people are like covered, their eyes covered in dust, or are asleep, basically. And the word Buddha means the awakened one, someone who's wakened up to the truth of things. So Buddha realized that others could wake up like he woke up. And so he thought, well, who could understand what I've got to teach? And then he had the psychic powers, and he realized his first teachers, his meditation teachers from years ago, could probably understand because they're already very developed in meditation. But then he realized again through his psychic powers that they'd already passed away. And then he thought, well, who else should I start with? And then he thought his former companions and students, his five companions who followed him from his hometown and been through all his adventures and through all the ascetic practices. Because in those days in India, the main spiritual practice was based upon an idea that the spirit is imprisoned within the body. So if you make the body very weak, then the spirit can emerge. So there were all these ascetic practices of fasting and going without sleep and going without this and going without that. And the Buddha did all those things for a number of years. And then he realized that it wasn't working. And so he changed his way of practice. And he recalled an event from his childhood, where at a big ceremony, he sat under a tree and just started to meditate in a very natural kind of way on his breath. And he experienced a kind of peace that he hadn't realized in the past few years of ascetic practices. So he decided just to very humbly, like, go back to his beginnings. But his friends felt that he was giving up, because he was brought up as a prince, and the astrologers had forecast greatness for him. You know, either he would become a great king, or he'd become a great religious teacher. So when he gave up his ascetic practices, his students, they all thought, yeah, he's had enough, he's going to go back to the palace. He's all right, he's a prince. You know, we've given up our youth and given up our lives for this, we don't have anything to go back to. So they were very disappointed in him. And they went off like 200 or 300 kilometers away to a place where all the ascetics like to gather, a place called Sarnath, the deer park. And so when the Buddha decided he would go and teach them, he walked from Bodh Gaya, where he was enlightened, 200-300 kilometers along the way. And as he was walking along, he met a man on the path. So this was his first ever teaching, you know, really as a Buddha. And this man on the path, he was so taken by the Buddha's radiance and beauty. And he said, "What are you? And are you a man?" And the Buddha said, "No." And he said, "Are you a god?" And he said, "No." He said, "Well, what are you?" "So I'm a Buddha." And of course, this man didn't know what Buddha meant. And so he said, "Yeah, maybe you are." And he just walked off. Yeah. And so then that was, you know, when the Buddha decided maybe rather than just saying, "I'm a Buddha," he had to come up with something a little bit more structured, which was, you know, when he eventually met the five ascetics, he gave this beautiful, profound talk on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which was the structure underlying all his teachings for the rest of his life, 45 years. But the, so the Buddha was a Buddha. And in the Buddhist teachings, at least, it's thought that he was the teacher of gods and men, or gods and human beings. So all the devas, the gods and the Brahma gods, the gods of all the different levels of heaven, looked to the Buddha as a teacher. So he wasn't a god, he was a teacher of gods. Now, in the 19th century, the time when most of Buddhist Asia was under the control, the governance of Western powers, and a lot of Christian missionary activity, and then there arose something we call like scientific Buddhism. And this is a movement in which people were looking back to strengthen their roots to oppose the Christian missionaries. So they were trying to emphasize all the ways in which Buddhism was rational, scientific, realistic, in contrast with what they proposed was an irrational, emotional Christianity. So this side of Buddhism was really emphasized. You know, this is like very rational and reasonable and scientific. And so that whole side of the Buddha was kind of downplayed, the sort of the miraculous side. But it is very much part of our understanding of the Buddha. For instance, on the night of his enlightenment, his enlightenment itself took place just before dawn, and he'd been sitting in meditation from the previous evening. Now in India, they divide nighttime into three periods. They call the three watches of the night. So from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. is the first watch of the night. 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. is the second watch of the night. And 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. is the third watch of the night. So Buddhist monks, like myself, always told that the middle watch of the night is for sleeping. 10 to 2 a.m. That's the time when you should rest. Any time outside of that is like bonus, but that's your basic time for rest. And in the first watch of the night, that first period, the Buddha had one great realization, and that was he could remember numberless past lives. So, you know, sometimes you read things about past lives. Someone could remember they were Cleopatra or something. It was sort of kind of corny and, you know. But the Buddha could remember millions of past lives. Millions. And you could imagine what a kind of revolutionary, incredible impact that would have upon your whole idea of who you are if you could remember millions of past lives. And in the middle watch of the night, he developed the ability to see the movement of beings through all the different realms in the universe, and how and why people move between hell realms and human realm and animal realm and heaven realm and godly realm. So he understood, like as a direct experience, the working of what we call the law of karma. So, you know, these two knowledges, you know, they already, you know, would take you, you know, to a realm beyond what we would normally characterize as godlike knowledge. But it was the third period of the night when he realized the complete freedom from suffering and all its causes that was the culmination, and at which point he became a Buddha. Now, the Buddha's teaching was focused on freedom, inner liberation. And he was very clear that psychic powers, there's never any question at that time and in that culture that these things existed, because there were so many people meditating and there were so many people with these experiences. It wasn't like a question, are these things real? But the important issue was really, what should your relationship between be towards those things? How much interest should you take in them? And the Buddha said that they're dangerous, because it's not like you want to meditate and practice to change yourself from an ordinary person to like a Superman and to have all these special powers and be special. Because being someone who's special is just as much suffering as being someone who thinks themselves ordinary. It's just a different kind of suffering. Okay? As long as you have an identification, I'm like this, then you're suffering. Okay? So the Buddha said, being able to read other people's minds or to levitate, so what, basically. That's the Buddhist attitude. Yes, it's possible, but so what? Why would you want those things? So they're not goals of spiritual life. And in fact, one of the important rules for a Buddhist monk is, if a Buddhist monk has such a power, he's forbidden from revealing it to someone who's not a monk. You can only talk about it amongst monks, because you don't want people to become fascinated or inspired by things like this. You want to be inspired by the teachings and by the practice, not by something that you could, these days with CGI, you know, you can watch in a movie. You know, anyone can do it. And so the Buddha said that the wonder, the most wonderful thing about the Buddha was his ability to teach people to find freedom. It wasn't his ability to do all these incredible things. There are very few cases when the Buddha actually, in all those years, used or demonstrated his psychic powers. And they're very interesting why he chose these special cases. One was when he visited home. And he wanted to teach his dad. Because everybody knows that people who have the most fixed ideas about who you are your parents. You know, they think, oh, I know you. You've never changed. You're always like this. You'll always be like this. No one knows you like your mum and dad. So when the Buddha returned home, everybody else says, wow, you know, Buddha. And his dad just says, oh, you know, it's my son come home. Why is he dressed like that, shaved head, you know. That's kind of normal. And so the Buddha performed the most difficult feat of psychic power, because there is, you know, sort of different levels. And the most difficult one is to levitate in the air and make one half of your body fire and the other half water. And that's the most, you know, wonderful thing. And so the Buddha did this for his dad. And his dad saw it, and I think he sort of, yeah, that's not the son that I used to know, you know. And so the idea is, if someone's mind is so kind of rigid and decided, they can't accept new ideas. And so sometimes you have to give them a shock to put them in the state in which they can learn something. And that this was the only time when the Buddha would use the psychic powers. The other time that everybody, many people know, is with the murderer, Angulimala, who used to kill people and then cut off their fingers, and he had a like a necklace of fingers. So he's like the first serial killer that we're familiar with in world literature, I think. And he and the Buddha went to teach him. But of course, as someone who's just caught up in killing and collecting fingers and wearing them around his neck, you know, he's not going to want to listen to a talk. So the Buddha walked in front of him, and so he chased after him with a big, you've probably seen pictures, haven't you? But he can't catch up with him. You know, it's like really weird because he's running and the Buddha's walking and he's not catching up with him. And he says, "What's going on?" And he says, "Stop, stop." And the Buddha says, "I stopped already. You're the one who hasn't stopped." And because it was just such a totally weird and inexplicable situation, it made him stop and think, "What's going on here?" And then the Buddha could teach him. And I think one of the reasons why this has always been such a central or famous episode in the Buddha's life is because it's a good story, but also because it shows that even someone who's killed people still has within them the capacity or the potential for enlightenment. Yeah. So, okay, that's an example of a very long answer to a question which was more or less like a talk, okay? But we can have shorter answers if you prefer. Does anyone else have anything they'd like to? Yes. Yes. A slight digression before I answer your question, because it's quite interesting. A lot of what we know about Buddhism in India now is due to the work of British civil servants who went there during the period of the British Raj and became very interested in the history of India, and a lot of the discovery of major Buddhist sites was due to the work of these British civil servants, and the translation of the Asoka columns and so many different historical monuments. But when they were first discovered Buddhism, and they didn't really know what it was, they came across all these Buddha images, and they had these like curly hair, and they were like really astounded, how is this possible? You know, because no Indians have this curly hair. And then one British scholar came forth with a theory, and this was the like accepted theory for some 20, 30 years, that the Buddha was a king from Ethiopia, who came to India and conquered India, and then afterwards they made him into a god. Because they saw, like in Ethiopia, and why Ethiopia, but that's where they said, they had like curly hair, and so they thought the Buddha was from Ethiopia. The Buddhism, at the time of the Buddha, the orthodox or the majority religion was Brahmanism. And Brahmanism is not one and the same thing as what we nowadays call Hinduism. So although Hindus, you know, probably wouldn't agree with this, I would suggest the historical evidence is very clear. And Brahmanism was characterized by what we call the caste system, where people are socially divided into different castes. And you're born into a caste and you live in that caste for your life. So there's the priestly caste, the warrior caste, the merchant caste, and the worker caste. And then you have other people who are so low they're not even considered part of the system. It's called the... Now, the Buddha found that there were a number of teachings in the Brahmin religion which didn't conflict with his teaching, and he gave them credit for that. But he was very critical of the caste system because it opposes the fundamental principle of Buddhism that you are what you do, basically. You are a good person or a bad person or whatever, not because of the caste you were born into or the social class you were born into, your family name, but what you do, how you live your life. So it's the teaching of action and the education of action, whereas the caste system is saying basically who you are is a function of what class, what group of people you're born into. So the Buddha was very critical of the caste system. And for this reason, he was not popular with the Brahmins. Now, Buddhism spread throughout India until there was right from the beginning a reaction from the Brahmins. And there's periods of suppression or repression of Buddhists by Brahmin kings. For instance, in Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened, one Brahmin king that killed all the monks and then cut down the Bodhi tree where the Buddha was enlightened, dug out the roots and burned them, and then put poison down. And so there's like a long history of repression of Buddhists by the Brahmins. But another key event was the reforms led by a great Brahmin teacher in the south of India called Shankaracharya. And he adopted many of the most popular of the Buddhist practices and incorporated them into the Brahmin tradition, particularly like vegetarianism, which we now associate with what we call Hinduism, which was not originally a tradition, but it was one that became popularized by the Mahayana Buddhists. And so taking a number of the most popular Buddhist traditions and revamping they'll have something that we can, I mean, this is very general, we can call Hinduism, which got back many of the converts to Buddhism. But there were also internal weaknesses in the Buddhist community and some corruption over the period of hundreds of years. To cut a long story short, the final blow to Buddhism in northern India was the Muslims coming in from eastern Turkey and just destroying all Buddhist monuments and Buddhist images, and basically killed everyone who wouldn't convert to Islam. So that was like, but it wasn't that like Buddhism disappeared from India because of the cruel Muslims, but because it was already, you know, it'd been a long history, both of repression from other groups and also corruption and weakness within the Buddhist community itself. So it's a number of different factors. Don't forget also that Buddhism flourished in India for well over 1,000 years. So it's not like it was just a short period. You know, and then, of course, spread to and through Sri Lanka to Southeast Asia. So tradition has not disappeared And now, at the present day, there's a revival of Buddhism in India, which is chiefly due to a man called Dr. Ambedkar, who was from the Chandala, the group of people that are, what do they call them? Without the casteless people, not even within the caste system. And Ambedkar got a scholarship to Britain and was a lawyer and was responsible for drafting the Indian constitution. And he studied the different religions, and he decided the way to take people out of their dire situation in the Hindu culture was to become Buddhist. So there were mass conversions of Buddhists from the late 40s, early 50s, which has been going on until present day. So we are now in India, we call like the new Buddhist movement is quite large and significant, politically significant as well. Indeed. Okay. Yes.
So, also, my question about question. So, I think if you are a doctor, what is the reason? Just because you know, so you know.
Sorry, you have to speak up a bit louder. Okay, well, that's a big question. First of all, concerning Buddha images and the representations of the Buddha, statues and so on, in the first days of Buddhism, we didn't have any of those at all. If you go to a place called Sanchi in central India, where it's one of the oldest Buddhist monuments, you'll see these stone friezes, and and you can see that there was a taboo against representing the Buddha's image, just like there is in Islam to this day. And there would be like a chariot and then like a space where the Buddha would be sitting, or, you know, just in like an empty space would represent the Buddha. But at the same time, even at the time of the Buddha, people would go to see the Buddha and want to pay their respects to him. And they'd be very disappointed if he wasn't there. And so Venerable Ananda said to Buddha, such a shame when people come and they want to pay their respects to you and they don't see you because you're away. And the Buddha said, well, they can pay their respect to the Bodhi tree because this was where I was enlightened. So this is a symbol of my enlightenment. So they can bow means that they can show their respect to the symbol of enlightenment. And that custom is still, to this day, is very strong in Sri Lanka, like bowing to the Bodhi tree. Not so much in Thailand or even Burma, I think. But as Buddhism spread, it came into contact with the major political force of those days and military force, which was the Greeks. And in what's present-day Pakistan, Afghanistan, was a country called Gandhara. And the Buddhists, Gandhara, came into contact with the Greek culture there, and the Greeks had the statues of Apollo. And so the Buddhists thought, well, that's really cool. And so they copied, like, the statue of Apollo, but they make for, like, Buddha. Yeah. And so that was how Buddha images first came to be. But the idea of Buddha images is that the Buddha said the Buddha is the Dhamma, okay? So it's not like a person. And the three qualities that express Buddhahood, or what it means to be a Buddha, one is wisdom, one is compassion, and the third is purity or freedom from defilements and negative mental states. So these are abstract things, you know, there's not something that you can see and look at. And so the idea of Buddha images was to create a figure that expresses these qualities. So if you have real trouble trying to, you know, now the Buddha's not alive and you can't go and bow to him yourself or learn to him, you have something that can remind you of wisdom and compassion and purity. And this is the rationale and why Buddha images were sculpted and carved, and this one is from Burma actually up here, and used throughout the Buddhist world. But of course, as you see, Buddhism is a different kind of religion from the religions that grew up in the Middle East. This family of religions in the Middle East of Judaism, Christianity, Islam. It's like one family. They share some books together, very similar idea of what a religion is. And we can summarize those religions, that religious family, as they are basically belief systems. You have to believe in the dogmas of those religions before you can be a member of that religion. And so it's become customary for us to understand religion as being a set of beliefs. You adopt a set of beliefs to become a member of a religion. But Buddhism is a different kind of religion. It's a different family. And it's why many people who are, you know, are followers of the belief system religions, they say, oh, Buddhism is not a religion, it's a philosophy or it's a way of life, because it doesn't fit in their category or their understanding of what a religion is. But we might say, well, who are you to decide what a religion is? You know, why does the Western world, you know, have the power to decide on the categories and what is and what is not a religion? What we can say is it's a different kind of religion, and it's a religion as education system. So the Buddhism is essentially not a belief system, it's an education system, okay? This is a fundamental to understanding what Buddhism is about. So that being the case, it's a lot harder to take care of Buddhism and transmit Buddhism, because it's not a matter of saying, okay, if you want to be a Buddhist, you have to believe this, 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 and this. You just believe these things and just do these things, you're a Buddhist. Buddhism means you have to put some effort into changing your life in terms of educating how you relate to your family and society. You have to learn how to train your mind. You have to learn to educate your thinking. These are fundamental to a Buddhist life. But obviously, over the course of centuries, there have been times when Buddhism becomes weak and the education is not being followed by the monks and the nuns and is not being transmitted to the lay Buddhists well. At that time, other kinds of beliefs can come in and mix up with the Buddhist beliefs. And so one of the essential or most fundamental desires of human being is to have somebody sort things out for us, someone who's perfect, someone who loves us and power, someone we can pray to and say, please do this, please do that. So inevitably, in a course of Buddhist history, in almost all Buddhist countries, you found people starting to pray to Buddha images. But it's important to understand that that is not what Buddha images are for. It's the opposite. They're there for us to pay our respects, to humble ourselves. So when we humble ourselves to a Buddha image, it means we're saying, I'm humbling myself before wisdom, compassion, and purity. And the most perfect and beautiful example of a human being expressing in their life wisdom, purity, and compassion was the Buddha. Okay? And he was the teacher and person who explained the way to educate ourselves and to develop within ourselves wisdom, purity, and compassion. Okay? So if someone is bowing to Buddha and say, may I pass my exams, or may I have a child, or, you know, it's normal, yeah. But how in most Buddhist countries it's handled is you have like a non-Buddhist shrines, you know, like Brahmin shrines or nats or whatever. And you want to ask for things, don't ask for the Buddha, you go and ask for those things. So it's like, you know, like a different ministry, you know, you go over there for that. Okay. Your second question was about, what was the second question? Oh, why did I become Buddhist when there's a whole supermarket to choose from? Well, I was brought up in England. But England now is a very, or even from when I grew up in the 60s, 70s, it was already quite a secular country, which means that the influence of Christianity was getting weaker and weaker. And in middle-class families, very few, I mean, certainly amongst my generation, young people, it's like not cool, you know, they could say, go to church. And but I myself had never had any kind of feeling of connection with Christianity since I was a child. I just couldn't, it just didn't make sense to me. You know, I just couldn't believe it, basically. And I was very ill as a child. I had asthma. So I spent a lot of time, I was more studious than most boys because I didn't go to school, basically. You know, if you go to school, you just play sports and play around. But because I was at home, I read a lot. So I was very kind of thought thinking a lot, and it didn't make sense, the teachings, you know, particularly the existence of suffering, and an all-powerful, all-loving God, how can you explain all the suffering in the world? And I didn't think that ever really been explained, at least to my satisfaction. So I had a lot of, I just think, well, you know, I don't see a need to believe in things to lead a good life. I can lead a good life without having to believe in a book. But as I got older, and in my teens, the questions that really came up in my mind is, what is a good life? You know, is that even a reasonable question? You know, does that make sense? Can you ask that question? Or can you say, this is a better life than this life? Or this is the best life? So what is the best life? You know, what are the criteria? What would you use to make that kind of judgment? This is better than that. And that was like one question very important for me. Another question was, why is there so much suffering in the world? Why is there so much cruelty and oppression and injustice and so on? And does it have to be like this? Is it just something you have to put up with? Or is there something that can be done about it? And if there is something that can be done about it, what should you do about it? What is your responsibility as a human being regarding the suffering in the world? So these were the questions that I didn't think had anything to do with religion or what I thought religion meant. But I thought, I've got to sort these things out, you know, before I make any real choices about how I'm going to live my life. So I started to read a lot of philosophy and psychology and all kinds of things. And then, you know, I came across teachings of the Buddha, and, you know, from first pages, I said, oh, yeah, it's just common sense. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, just real, this is what I've been looking for. So I was, you know, really filled with faith through reading a book that answered the questions about life that I felt was most important to ask. And so I felt I had a direction in my life from that point. And then after I finished high school, I worked and saved some money, and then I went to India, and I was traveling and around in India and Asia for a couple of years, trying to find out more and to And the more I studied and the more experiences I had, the more convinced I became that Buddha's teachings were authentic and real and practical, and that I wanted to give my life to them. So your third question was... Was that the third or fourth question? The third question about the whole universe. Yeah, well, it's not in Buddhist texts, but I'm of the opinion, I go along with the idea of multiple universes and multiple Buddhas. So I don't have any proof of that. It makes sense to me. Yeah. For one thing, if you compare, say, the Buddha with Jesus or some of the other religious teachers, like Jesus was a poet, okay, wonderful poet. But Jesus would say something like, you want to go to the kingdom of heaven, you have to become like a small child. Okay, it's like beautiful. The Buddha would never say that. You know, the Buddha would say, if you want to go to heaven, you know, you can adopt some of the characteristics of a child, like point one, point two, point three, point four. But you should not be like a child in this and this and this and this, you see. So he wasn't a poet. He was very kind of precise and scientific. So, when the Buddha uses some of the similes the Buddha gives, these are not just for poetic effect, emotional effect. And the Buddha said that the tears, if you were to collect all the tears that have fallen from your eyes in previous lives, the water would exceed that of all the oceans in the world. Now, that's either like poetry, yeah, or he's making a real statement. Now, if he's a real statement, there's no way, given what we know about the history of this world and the length of time that human beings have lived in this world and the number of generations, that could be possible. You know, even if you were to be crying all day, every day, for the rest of your life, for 100 lives, you know, you wouldn't have enough to fill even, you know, a pond, probably, or at least a sea, let alone all the seas in the world. So, my hypothesis is that we're talking about multiple universe, and that's including all the universes, all the past times, and all the different universes. Pardon? Why not? Yeah. I mean, what do you mean by gods, anyway? Why would you? What's your supporting evidence for such a figure? Well, it's also, you know, we're always, this is a kind of a very old problem, isn't it? If you say that there must have been someone creating the universe, then there must have been somebody before the universe. Okay, well, where did he come from or she come from? Yeah. Well, so he must or she must have had a creator. But if he and she had a creator, well, who was their creator? You have this infinite regress, you see. So what the Buddha says is the idea that things need a beginning is just a human idea. What is there anywhere that you can point to and says that has a beginning or a creator? Is there anything you can see that's actually made from nothing? You know, what we can see is different elements come together temporarily, you know, and into a form of a microphone or into the form. But there must be things there already for that to be created. So the Buddha, you know, if you believe what the Buddha said, that he could remember millions of past lives, and millions of, like, eons. Now, the idea of an eon is, if you can imagine the time, you imagine like a mountain, which is like 15 kilometers long, 15 kilometers wide, 15 kilometers high, made of metal. And once every 100 years, a bird flies by with a feather, and the feather of the bird just brushes against that iron mountain. So the amount of time that it would take for that feather, once 100 years, to wear down a mountain, 15 kilometers long, wide, and high, is one eon. Okay? And the Buddha could remember many eons. And he said, there is no discoverable beginning of all this. So he didn't actually say there's no beginning, but he's saying that going back, you know, through the innumerable big bangs and universes coming together and dissolving, there's no discoverable beginning of this. So, you know, so we're in the realm of speculation here. There's no way we can prove this. But what we can say is, on what do we base the idea that everything should have a beginning? Why? I mean, everybody says it's obvious, but is it really obvious? You think about it. Yes. That's right, you don't need to stand up. You can sit down there. Yeah.
One question is about in the world we have a lot of different kinds of plants in China. The monk cannot eat meat, just a vegetable. And in Thai, monk can eat meat. And in Japan, monk can marry. And including in Tibet. I think one way can let you
Well, these are for historical, social, cultural reasons. Big topic, but I'll. Buddhism, after the Buddha passed away, then Buddhism spread out over a big area and developed different schools and different traditions. So the tradition in Thailand comes from Sri Lanka, which came from northern India in the time of the Emperor Asoka. This tradition we call Theravada, or used to be called Hinayana, but it's not such a nice word, say Theravada, is characterized by its very conservative. And the idea, the basic idea is to preserve the teachings of the historical Buddha. Okay? Now, when Buddhism spread northwards into Tibet, China, and all into Afghanistan, Iran, and all those Stan countries, Kazakhstan, they were all Mahayana Buddhist at one time. Then those monks in those schools, their underlying, we call them Mahayana, but there are many different schools. Like Mahayana is not like one school like Theravada. Mahayana is like umbrella term for many different groups, with kind of different teachings, but all with the basic idea of practicing to be free of suffering. There they found different cultural traditions, and they were much more liberal or willing to adapt to the prevailing culture. For instance, in India, the tradition of the monk going on alms round in the morning, or for the lay people to support the spiritual people with their basic need for food and clothing, is very deep in Buddhism from before the time of the Buddha. But when the Buddhist monks went to China, they found it was a big problem. When they went on alms round, Chinese people thought they were lazy. Why don't you work like anybody else? Because they didn't have that tradition. So over a course of more than 100 years, the decision was to give up on the alms round. So big change for the monks now. They have to become self-sufficient. Now, for the monks on alms round, the idea is you don't make, don't be fussy. You don't make a problem for the people. They're so generous. You don't say, I want this food, I don't want that food. Okay, so if they want to put meat in your bowl, it's okay. You don't have to eat it. You're not compulsory, you know, to eat it. but you shouldn't refuse the gift of faith. But when the monks go to China, now they're self-sufficient, now they have control. They can say, okay, we don't want to raise cattle and kill animals for food. We're going to grow crops. And so vegetarianism became the standard because the monks are receiving food in a different way. They're growing food themselves, not dependent on offering from lay people who are not vegetarian. In Tibet, then whereas in China, then the monks are facing the culture of Confucianism and Taoism, and so making some changes and some adaptation over a long period, exceeding that influence. In Tibet, then there is the pre-existing Bun religion. It's like a magical religion. And so the first Buddhist groups were very much influenced by this, particularly the Nyingma sect. And in that sect, the monk would marry. But in the Dalai Lama sect, they don't marry. They're celibate. So that's a reform sect. In Japan, after some hundreds of years, there was Buddhist leader who said, now this is a corrupt period of time. We can't become enlightened like the monks in the old days. We should just be humble and accept that. And we shouldn't be celibate. We monks, we should just get married and be humble, normal human being, but be a spiritual leader in the community. So that was when the tradition of some sect of Japanese Buddhists, the monks became priests, they got married. But the majority did not for a long time. But in Japan, monks became very involved in politics. And in the 19th century, there was a military coup, and the military government, the Meiji Restoration, took place. And they wanted to reduce the political power influence of the monks. And the method was to make a law, make it compulsory. All the monks had to get married. So this is why in Japan, nearly all the monks get married. And once you get married, then everything changes and you have family and you have family responsibilities and you have temples and you pass your temple on to your younger son. And the whole strength of the institution, the political strength, fell away. So this is reason why some Buddhist countries, the monks get married and some they don't. But in Theravada, we're still following the teachings of the Buddha, historical Buddha, and part of becoming a monk means that you're giving up family life.
If a monk joins the different part of the Buddhism, they are ready to be monk, but they still have a fix with the lady. So
as a Buddhist, you can choose which kind of Buddhism, you're inspired by. But the thing is, you have to be, have integrity with regard to the kind of Buddhism that you join. So when I become a Buddhist monk, then I make a firm vow or promise that I give up all sexual activity. And in my tradition, if a monk has any sexual relation with the woman, then from that very moment, even if nobody knows, he's no longer a true monk. He's an imposter. And he makes if a monk is to have the sexual relation with a woman, is still wear a robe and people come and bow to him, or he takes food or offerings, is very bad karma, really bad karma. So if your tradition you join says you want to become a monk, you can't get married, okay, you make that promise and you keep it. But if you want to become a priest and lead a more spiritual life, but you still would like a family life, then there are Buddhist sects that allow you to do that, so you would join that one. Yeah.
So do we have any
Yes. Well, yes, I mean, it's interesting. If you were to read a book on Theravada Buddhism, you know, and some of the books, it's about suffering, and it's like really miserable, you know. And then you say, just as an exercise, imagine there was a country, and most 95% of the people follow this religion. What do you think they would be like? And you would think, reading the book, you know, they would be really kind of miserable, life suffering, it's miserable, you know. And then you come to Thailand and everybody's smiling and happy, and like you say, put a big value on enjoyment. And, you know, the one that you probably know, that if you want to, like, guess the essence of a culture, usually you find the words that you can't translate into other languages. They express that culture the best. And one of the words in Thai is sunuk. You know, you can translate as fun, but it's not really, you know, it's much more profound than that. So this is a sunuk culture, okay? It's this culture which puts a lot of importance on something being sunuk, or good fun. So yeah, to what extent that is influenced by Buddhism, I think it's a very complex question. There is an excellent history book of Southeast Asia written, I can't remember, an Australian academic. And he writes about the whole of Southeast Asia as being a block. And particularly if you look at the time preceding the influence of Christianity and Islam in Southeast Asia, you read something about people in Indonesia or Philippines, and you think you're reading about Thailand. So there seemed to be this kind of, you know, fun, easygoing, that kind of thing seemed to be like a Southeast Asian phenomena rather than specifically Thai. But with different cultural and social influences, it's not quite so clear cut these days. But I still think that if you go to Indonesia, like Indonesian Muslim with a Middle Eastern Muslim, same religion but very different kind of feeling, and similarly a Thai Christian or a, you know, an American Christian, there's kind of different. So there is some kind of a basic cultural something just in the genes of the people, if you like, that seems to be independent of the religion. But I would say that because Buddhism is not like I say a belief system religion, it's always been incredibly tolerant, to the extent that there's no word for tolerance in the Thai language. You know, this idea we should promote religious tolerance, you know, why? Well, because we've suffered so much from intolerance in the past. But in Thailand, there's never been a history of intolerance. The idea for a Buddhist that you should hate somebody or should try to change somebody because they have a different religion or a different belief or a different sexual orientation is very alien to Thai culture. So for that reason, it's very kind of open. But because it's so open, sometimes, you know, it's too open, and it's kind of really kind of sloppy and you know. but, you know, that's the kind of open-mindedness that is very much part of Thai culture, which I think you can relate to Buddhism in terms of its attitude to other belief systems, other religions, other people who are not the same as you, basically. As far as the things not to do, five things are the basic Buddhist code for lay people. One is killing, harming. Second is stealing. Third is sexual misconduct, which means adultery, rape, sex with underage or people who are forbidden by law. In any way of cheating on your girlfriend or your boyfriend is wrong. And the third, fourth is lying. And the fifth is taking alcohol or drugs. So those are the five what we call precepts of a lay Buddhist. But the most in terms, so that's like the precepts, but the karma, the most extreme acts that can be performed. One is killing a mother, killing father, or killing an arahant or enlightened being. There are two others not going to come up, but those are considered to be of the worst possible effect on the next life and on and something that you can't remedy. Many bad things, if you change your life, you can remedy and make better. But these three things are so serious that it's not possible to remedy.
You mentioned that a lot of Tibetan Brahmins end up getting involved with the Thai Buddhism. And many people say that these things corrupt the true Buddhism of teaching because people use it for distracting and for pleasure purposes. Do you think that these things need to be removed or clarified, please?
Yeah, I think clarified is the word. I mean, Buddhism is not that kind of, crusading religion. They're saying we've got to stamp out heresy in the Buddhist way. That's kind of not there at all. But I think that because Buddhists are so kind of generally tolerant and open-minded, that when that is combined with a lack of good education about Buddhist teachings, then you get a lot of non-Buddhist elements mixed up with the Buddhist elements, and people don't really realize. And it's the job of the spiritual leaders or professionals like myself to be pointing out, okay, if you want to go and light incense and ask some deity to help you pass your exams, you've got a right to do that. Who can tell you not to? But don't think that that's a Buddhist practice. That's a non-Buddhist custom. Now, if you want to combine Buddhist customs with non-Buddhist customs, that's your freedom. I don't think it's such a good idea, but I can understand why that might be a temptation.
Mm-hmm. The reason I brought this up is because a lot of people mix this up happening into the world.
Yeah.
It's a greed, it's a anger, it's a grasp.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. That's why, I was saying Buddhism has to be the path of education. And the question for us is, if we're worried about this, is how to get through to people who do that. And I think when you say, that's wrong, that's stupid, that's not Buddhism, you've got it all wrong, that's not a very good way to go about it, because people just get defensive and say, who are you to tell me? Leave me alone. But I think that if we can recognize, why people do things and acknowledge their stress, their sense of insecurity or their fears for the future, and recognize when people do good things and kind things, but then be pointing out, that this, the Buddha taught us to believe in the power of our actions, and that we change our life for the better with the power of our actions, and that there's no deity there that has that kind of power over your life in that way. But basically, you know, if there is, just suppose that there is some kind of a deity, a god there, who's interested enough in you to want to have some mystical effect on your exam results, then we say, well, what kind of deity is that? You know, if he's doing it because of something you're offering him, then basically he's taking a bribe. So how is it that, you know, you get very upset about corruption in the civil service, but you're willing to support corruption in the world of the unseen world of deities who live in spirit shrines, you know? Because it's the same thing. You say, I'll give you some money, you give me what I want, or I'll give you this and you give me that. So it's kind of like some very worldly kind of exchange. And so, yeah, we're putting out, the Buddha has a different idea about why things happen the way they do and what to do about it, rather than just hoping that some mysterious entity is going to sort things out for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, the thing with proof is, and you know, we talk very glibly about, oh, we need proof, but the question is, what's the proof that your proof is a legitimate proof? You understand? That's too philosophical. Okay. Let me take a step back. Buddhism, as I say, is like an education system. And often people from other religious traditions, they assume it's a belief system. So they say, oh, you're a Buddhist, that means you believe in reincarnation. Okay? So if you say yes, you're just falling into a trap because you're accepting their kind of understanding of what your religion is. Now, for a Buddhist, we start off with basic thing is believing in something is not the same as knowing something. Okay? This is absolutely really, really important to recognize. So let's take the most obvious example, at least for me, from my childhood. When I was a small boy, I had an absolute faith in the existence of Santa Claus. Okay? 24th of December, night of Christmas, I couldn't sleep. Just so excited. Santa Claus is going to come down the chimney and bring my presents. Okay? And then after some years, whenever it was, I discovered that there was no such thing as Santa Claus. Now, what that proved to me is that it is possible to have an absolute, unshakable faith in something that is not true. Okay? Would you accept that? Now, you can see now there are many times in the world where we see people who have two opposing beliefs, and each one is absolutely convinced that they are true, but they don't. They can't both be true. So if you have Mr. A and Miss B, what we can say is either Mr. A is correct and Miss B is mistaken, or Miss B is correct and Mr. A is mistaken, or they're both mistaken, but they can't both be right. So that means that in that case, one of these people absolutely convinced that they're true, that they're right, are wrong. And it's so important to be able to see when you have a really strong faith in something that that doesn't mean that therefore it is true. It's just a feeling, a faith. Now, what many people do is they make this jump. They say, this is true. It's true. And they say, well, how do you know? Because I believe it. I just know in my... What they don't know, that's not knowing. That's believing. Don't mix the two up. They're not the same thing. What you mean is, you have no doubts. You believe. Okay? But it becomes like circular reasoning. You say, it's true because I believe it. Yeah, well, why do you believe it? Because it's true. But how do you know it's true? Because I believe it. I believe it because it's true. It's true because I believe it. And this is, you know, where so many religious people get caught up and why there's so much conflict and killing and all the stuff that goes on because people don't make this fundamental distinction between believing something and knowing something, and humbly accepting that the fact that you believe doesn't mean, therefore, it is true. It is possible to believe in something that is not true. We have so many examples from study of history or study of the world today. So where does that leave us as a Buddhist? You say, oh, you're a Buddhist, you believe. Stop, no. What I can say about rebirth right now is, I don't know. Is there rebirth? You don't know, do you? No, you don't know. We'll start off there. You don't just start off right there. And why don't start up here? You don't know. Do you believe? Yeah. You can say, yeah, I don't know, but I believe. Well, why do you believe? Well, there's a lot of things that encourage my belief that I think are good proofs or support. There are all the teachings of the Buddha. There are many great meditators, monks and nuns who can remember past lives. There are children all around the world who have been proved to, they have been scientifically tested and so on, their books with their results of examination of children who remember past lives, usually from the age of 3 to 5, and not only in Buddhist cultures but non-Buddhist cultures. There are people who remember past lives under hypnosis. Now, the teachings of the Buddha himself, the fact that many great meditators, spiritual leaders, claim to be able to remember past lives, spontaneous past lives, memory on the part of children and people under hypnosis, are all very strong supports for a belief in rebirth. But they're not a proof, in the sense that you don't actually know. But they mean that your belief in rebirth is founded on good sense. It's not just an emotion, but you're ready to say, yeah, if you can have any new information to prove that my reasoning is for, I'm willing to listen, because I don't actually know. And I think that, part of the problem with interface and sort of trying to create harmony between religions is that they start off at the top. We all really believe in the same thing. We're all just using different language, and we can all be friends because actually we're all on the same page, But who knows? How could you say that? If you've never reached that level, what you're really saying is, wouldn't it be nice if that was true? Then we wouldn't have to hate each other. But Buddhism is saying, you don't have to believe the same thing to be friends. And why don't we just start off down below? I'm a Buddhist. I believe in rebirth. But, I don't really know. But, this is the reason I believe. And then if it was a Christian to say, I believe Jesus died for my sins. He's my savior. I don't actually know, but that's what I believe. And then a Muslim can say, I believe that Allah, there's only one God, his prophet is Allah, and his prophet is Muhammad, and I don't really know, but that's what I believe. Then you can have some harmony, not right up there, but right down here. Yeah, none of us know what we're talking about. Yeah. Let's just start off right there, from where we can actually agree on something which is not just wishful thinking or idealism, but we don't actually know. Let's be humble enough to start from there, and I think might be able to be a little bit more harmonious than it is at the moment. Yeah. Well, you can't prove in terms of lifetimes, okay, that things happening in your present life are due or influenced by things in the past. But that is a reasonable hypothesis. For instance, in case of childhood prodigies or children that are born with bone cancer or AIDS or things like this, when you say, how do you explain that, from a belief in God? If you believe there's only one life, and that, how can you explain children who are born with most terrible illnesses from and how can you equate that? So we feel like the idea that there is a causes and conditions from previous lives, it's not like they're being punished, but this is a causal process. That's a Buddhist hypothesis, okay? It's not Buddhist belief, but this is makes sense to us from what we understand from what the Buddha taught. So we can say, yeah, I believe it based on what I've studied, but I don't actually know, okay? But what you can see very clearly is by looking at your life and seeing the effects that your decisions make on the quality of your life, okay? So I'll give you a very simple example. Let's suppose you're in a group and there's some person that you really don't like and they act in very selfish, unpleasant ways. And you think, well, you know, I'm not going to lose my temper. I'm just going to be very patient, not going to say anything. And you just sit there and just try to be patient. And then one day you lose it. You know, it's just too much. And you just, you know, just shout at them or tell them off and come on, you know, grow up or, you know, don't. Okay. Now, notice that the next day that person acts in the same way, the likelihood that you're going to react in the same way and tell them off or get angry is much more now because you've acted upon that impulse and now you've created a habit and it becomes easier and easier to behave in that way every time that you behave in that way. This is karma. So if you speak kindly to somebody and you make a practice of speaking kindly, then after a while, it becomes, we say, second nature. It's creating good karma. It becomes easier to speak kindly, more kindly than unkindly. It's just cause and effect in daily life. It's just, if you feed, the good impulse, the good impulse becomes stronger and the weak impulse becomes weaker. So, like, for instance, if you have you take the precepts, say precept not to kill, okay? So, first, like a mosquito bite, you know, okay, not gonna kill the mosquito. So first, you know, it's kind of, because you've always killed mosquitoes, you feel really weird, you know, but then suppose you can. First time, it's really difficult. Second time, it's easier, it becomes easier and easier. So you don't even think about it. Well, why would I kill a mosquito? Well, I can just blow him away or, you know, just do something else. And that's karma, is creating new habits. And as you create that new habit, say, of not killing something, then all kinds of interesting things happen, like this sense of love and compassion arises naturally when you don't kill things, and your sense of self-respect, you start to like yourself more. It feels really good to feel, I'm someone who doesn't kill, I'm someone who doesn't hurt other beings, whatever the cause, whatever. And so on a conventional level, you're recreating your whole idea of who you are. And, you know, in West, they talk a lot about self-esteem. And we talk about self-esteem as creating wise boundaries for your behavior and then being able to live within those boundaries voluntarily. It has to be voluntary. You know, you don't think I don't do that because I'm afraid of getting punished, but because this is how you're educating yourself. And then when you know that you can go into a situation where there'll be a lot of temptations or a lot of pressure, but you can still live within your boundaries, then there's a real feeling of self-esteem arises. No. So this is like in giving. Like in Thailand and in Burma, Buddhist countries, there's so much importance on giving. Because the highest level of spiritual development is a renunciation, letting go of attachment, inner attachment to mental states. It's very profound work. But you start that work off in the material realm by learning to share your possessions and to give something away. And so by doing that, you change your whole relationship to your possessions. rather than this is mine, I worked hard, now it's mine, I've got it, leave me alone. You find it's kind of magical. You get something and you think, wow, there's a lot in here. I could eat it myself, but I get far much more pleasure by sharing it out amongst my friends, And so your mind changes because you give and you give and you suddenly find it just feels so good to give. And you find just naturally you want to give more than you want to keep something for yourself. So this is how, law of karma is, it's just when you act, when you think in a particular way, you create certain habits, then it affects your life. And that's how we can prove a karma. And that works both for positive things and for negative things. And, you see people who get into the most negative and destructive kinds of situations, and sometimes people can just, how did I get here? How is it possible? I'm living my life in exactly the opposite way than I wanted to, like 10 years ago. And often it's not because you make the really bad choices. It's just you make small bad choices. Very, very small bad choices again and again and again and again and again and again. And, again. And suddenly, from I give this analogy. Let's suppose someone is very confident of their ability to walk in a straight line, okay, without a compass, okay, and willing to take bets on it, okay. So you go out to the middle of a desert or somewhere where there's no signs, no indication, and start off in the morning, okay, I'm going to walk 8 hours straight ahead without a compass. And let's say you do it, and you walk, and incredible, someone comes and measures, doesn't tell you, but you're only 1 degree off, like in a whole day of walking, without a compass, without any signposts. I mean, that's pretty incredible. So next day, you do it again, and you can do it again, a whole day, and you're just 1 degree off. Now, if you do that for 90 days, how far are you off? 90 degrees, and 180 days, 180 degrees. So from thinking you're walking north and absolutely confident you're walking in a straight line, you're walking south. You say, how am I walking south? I mean, I know I was walking in a straight line. I mean, I know, see? And that's so often what happens in our life, just little by little by little by little, we make these small choices and we create this karma until we're completely somewhere completely different from where we thought we would be or we should be. And this is why in Buddhism we talk so much about meditation and giving some time just to come back to the present moment in a formal kind of way with your eyes closed and just to reestablish yourself on the straight path again and again and again so that you're not continually deviating from where you want to be. So it's not just a matter of, it's not like meditation is something you do in order to get something, which is peace or whatever. But it's a way of just coming back to what's really going on in your life. And if you're completely confused when you meditate, well, that's a sign, that's telling you something about how you're living your life right now. You're getting some important information. It's not, waste of time, I can't meditate. Whenever I meditate, my mind's all over the place. The fact that your mind's all over the place is telling you something. Your life's out of balance. Your mind's not in a sufficient state where you can make really wise life choices, And a lot of things, when you just stop, just for a moment, a lot of things become clear. You may think, oh, I'm not very good at meditating, but you sit there and you're just kind of a little bit calm, and just something comes up and you realize, oh, that thing I've been worrying about so much, it's just that much, it's just so small. And then another time you might be thinking, oh, that thing that I thought was really nothing, that's really dangerous, I've got to stop that right now. So it's like you're communicating with yourself. Because we're so busy these days and communicating with this person and that person. And now you know, the ability to communicate with others is at a level it's never been in, you know, throughout history. You know, we can just, you know, if you were to tell somebody even 100 years ago, you know, you can just pick up something like this. I can do this. I can just press speed dial and speak with my mum in England. You know, and you tell somebody, who are you talking to? I'm talking to my mum in England. You know, 100 years ago, people were, you know, thought you were some kind of psychic power, you know. But so we're used to all this. But because it's so easy, you know, we're out of balance. You know, we're constantly communicating with others, and we're not communicating with ourselves. And what's this actually doing to the quality of our life and the kind of principles and ideals that we want to express in our life? So this is why it's important just to give some time to yourself, just to come back in the morning, just for a few minutes, just to be with your breath, just to be with your body, be with your mind, be with yourself, just to, you know, calmly establish yourself in mindfulness and clarity before you go off and do whatever you do during the day. Okay, well, I think that's probably enough today. Sorry, one more question at the back. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, the idea that bun or punya, merit and purity of heart is quantitative, meaning that if you give a monk 100 baht, then you get 100 units of merit, and 1,000 baht, 1,000 units of merit. I mean, this is so laughable and ridiculous. It's shocking that there could be monks teaching this in Buddhism in Thailand and not be laughed all the way out of the country. It's a sign of, you know, the decline of the sasana, and for many different reasons. No, the Buddha never made any such claim, obviously. I mean, it's common sense. The Buddha said that it's the purity of, it's the wish to share something with others and to give, to reduce suffering or to support something that is good and wise and noble. And that sense of joy that you get from helping others and from sharing and giving, that's the purity. And that's not going to, obviously, you know, why should that be any more if you give something for 1,000 baht and 100 baht or even 10 baht, you know? If it's a genuine act of kindness and generosity, then it's a beautiful thing. Yeah, it's just nothing to do with it's not like a bank in that way. So, yeah.